Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm going to be looking at the beginnings of Neville Chamberlain's prime ministership, and the foreign policy situation that he inherited. The reason why I want to do this is because Chamberlain is not so much a mythologized figure or even a demonized figure, but an oversimplified figure. The narrative that most people know is that Chamberlain visited Hitler in 1938 in Munich, and after several visits, essentially appeased Hitler and handed over the Sudetenland on the assumption that there would be no further annexations. And shortly afterwards, in early 1939, Hitler seized the remainder of Czechoslovakia, and then in September 1939 waged war against Poland, thus proving the policy of appeasement to have failed, which indeed it had. The thing about appeasement at the time, appeasement has only really become a dirty word in the aftermath of the Second World War. Appeasement at the time was seen, based on the context of the time, as a reasonable and rational policy. And it wasn't simply Chamberlain that thought that. There was a wide swathe of British public opinion and opinion across the Britain's political classes that thought much the same. So I want to kind of dig into Chamberlain a little bit here and start to kind of re-examine some of the things that we assume about him. So in this episode, I'm reading once again from Britain's War by Daniel Todman, which is a superb two-volume book. I'm looking at the first volume, 1937-41. And Daniel Todman writes, "During the final years of the 1930s, the sense that another world war was coming grew increasingly strong. The prolonged anticipation of this second cataclysm was one of the key differences from the outbreak of its predecessor, which had come as a total shock to Britons in the summer of 1914. In 1937, however, it did seem that more sufferings might yet be averted." He writes about Neville Chamberlain. "Neville Chamberlain arrived at 10 Downing Street determined to sort out the potentially disastrous international situation. Chamberlain succeeded Stanley Baldwin in 1937. Britain now faced the threat of three wars at the same time, with Germany in Europe, with Italy in the Mediterranean, and with Japan in the Far East. As far as Chamberlain was concerned, collective security was dead and the League of Nations defunct. Of Britain's potential allies, France was politically unstable, the USSR was ideologically antipathetic, and the USA was unreliably isolationist. Until Britain's rearmament programmes were more complete, it was in a vulnerable position, but the scale of those programmes themselves now threatened the economic revival. In this hazardous environment, keeping the British Empire safe would require a balancing act of global scope and epic complexity. Now here is the essence of Chamberlain's policy of appeasement. This is what it's all about. Chamberlain looking at the realities of the situation, recognising that war is perhaps unavoidable, but must be avoided nonetheless, and that if anything, Britain needed time to rearm, and that the prospect of war in Europe, not only unthinkable to an entire generation of people that had fought the First World War, but also unthinkable to Britain's military planners that simply saw Britain as unprepared for the fight, and also unable to defend the entirety of the British Empire. This was exactly the sort of problem, writes Daniel Todman, that Chamberlain liked to solve. 5 months into his premiership, he was already able to inform his sister that he had in mind far-reaching plans for the appeasement of Europe and Asia, and for the ultimate check of the mad arms race, which, if continued, must involve us all in ruin. At the base of these plans were two assumptions. The first was that a war was in nobody's interest, and the second was that it should be possible to resolve all the aggressor's powers' grievances by a process of interlinked negotiation rather than ad hoc reaction. Being strong enough to make violence look unattractive was a key part of Chamberlain's approach, but he saw no point in making threats that the USA couldn't, the UK could not back up, nor in constructing alliances that might precipitate an unnecessary war. So this was the world that Chamberlain viewed. He saw Hitler as a rational actor. There is a huge amount written about this. One of the key books on the subject was A.J.P. Taylor's Causes of the Second World War. And in that, A.J.P. Taylor very controversially said, well, Hitler was no more or less like any other mountebank, he called it, of a leader. He said basically he was trying to seize as much as he could using kind of brinkmanship and bluff for his country, whereas other views, I think perhaps more realistic views of Hitler, if you look particularly at Timothy Snyder, was that in his book Black Earth, is that Hitler wanted war. And Hitler wanted war because the war that Hitler wanted to fight was a racial war, and that Hitler's ideological worldview was racial, and that that all history was for Hitler was a racial struggle. These are the things that Chamberlain didn't perceive, and the idea that any leader would naturally wish to avoid war was something that was an article of faith to Chamberlain. But Chamberlain, when he finally did meet Hitler, became firm of the idea that Hitler could be reasoned with, and that Hitler was, as a rational actor, always inclined to avoid conflict, which of course turns out to not be true. Chamberlain found a welcome ally in the senior civil servant, Sir Horace Wilson, already installed in No. 10 as a special advisor to the Prime Minister. Wilson was a self-made man, the son of a furniture maker. He'd entered the civil service in 1900 as a boy clerk, and then taken a part-time degree at the London School of Economics. Having established a reputation for settling difficult industrial disputes during the Great War, in 1921 he was appointed permanent secretary to the Ministry of Labour, where he played an important part in ending the general strike. Although the unions resented him for his skill in unpicking their position before negotiations began, in 1930 the second Labour government made Wilson its chief industrial adviser, a title he retained for the rest of the decade. When Baldwin returned to Downing Street in 1935, he needs someone else to keep an overview of the business of government as it passed through the Prime Minister's office. Wilson was brought in to take up the job, and Chamberlain kept him on. So there you had the one of these kind of classic Downing Street double acts of a chief advisor or a chief mandarin and a prime minister. And prime ministers often lean on these figures and to act as almost the second brain, the decision maker. These two men had got to know each other well during the Ottawa trade talks in 1932, where's Todman. They were both hard-working, seemingly humourless figures with a strong grip on administration. Chamberlain's personality meant that his colleagues seldom became his comrades. And of the people he worked with, Wilson became probably the closest thing that he had to a friend. Sir Horace's position was powerful. All the papers coming into and out of 10 Downing Street passed through his office, and Chamberlain valued his advice on economic policy and the composition of his cabinet. On the 20th of May 1939, Wilson was made permanent secretary to the Treasury and head of the civil service, which put him in charge of the appointment of all senior officials in Whitehall. Wilson's enemies saw him as a Cardinal Richelieu figure, pulling the strings of power behind the throne. Wilson maintained that he was servant, not master. He supported Chamberlain, but he did not control him. Before long, however, Chamberlain would come to rely on Wilson as a diplomatic go-between, as well as a domestic political fixer. This reflected not only their shared belief that the international problem could be solved by finding grounds for reasonable agreement, but also Chamberlain's desire, and like his predecessor, to take a firm control of foreign policy. Baldwin had not necessarily little interest in foreign policy, but little ability in his eyes to determine it. It's worth just looking at Baldwin for a moment. Baldwin stepped down in 1937. He resigned his prime ministership to King George VI, and said essentially he was exhausted by the office. And he was exhausted by the strains of dealing with the international situation and also the domestic demands for peace. In 1935, Baldwin had won a landslide election. And in 1936, a by-election that was in Fulham was lost to the Conservatives, to the national government as it was at the time, because of the implication that the government might start to rearm. So Baldwin could say, "Well, you know, we have these threats emerging around the world, and yet there is no mandate in the country for rearmament." It's wildly unpopular, and indeed it was. I've talked in the past on this podcast about things like the Peace Pledge Union led by Father Dick Shepherd of St. Paul's Cathedral, and the popularity of the United Nations, and the widespread desire to never fight another war like the First World War. Figures like Churchill, of course, criticised Baldwin, said, you know, you are placing the needs of the party over the needs of the country, and rearmament is definitely needed, irrespective of what the general public say. Baldwin had also got himself involved in the Abyssinia crisis in 1935, where Mussolini had invaded Abyssinia, and the British and French, Samuel Hoare and Pierre Laval, the British and French diplomats, had negotiated together the secret Hoare-Laval Pact, which essentially gave Mussolini a free pass in Abyssinia. The belief was that if one could keep Mussolini sweet, then he wouldn't drift into Hitler's sphere of influence. Before 1936, Mussolini was more likely to favour the two democratic states, Britain and France. But as a result of the Abyssinia crisis, Mussolini, who is essentially given everything he wants by the British and the French, subsequently decides that seeing what Hitler has to offer is well worth it too.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So this was a huge, huge disgrace, and it led to almost a fate. It dealt the League of Nations almost a fatal blow. The two powers that were meant to be upholding the League of Nations more than anything else do more than any other power to undermine it and to engage in secret treaties, the kinds of which it was already decided were really, really completely unacceptable in this new era of diplomacy. So you have one prime minister who is essentially defeated by matters of foreign policy. That's not the only reason why he resigns. And a new prime minister determined not to be defeated by matters of foreign policy, indeed to finally resolve and solve these foreign policy questions that had dogged every prime minister since David Lloyd George. But there was a problem. Daniel Tobman writes, "The new prime minister's determination to solve the European situation himself put him at loggerheads with the Foreign Office. His willingness to appease Hitler aroused shrill opposition from the Foreign Office's senior civil servant, Sir Robert Vansittart, a long-term Cassandra of the dangers of German revival. Chamberlain also found himself in disagreement with the Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, who had grown used to doing what he wanted while Baldwin was Prime Minister. Over the rights and wrongs of German expansion in Central and Eastern Europe, Eden differed little from the Prime Minister, although given his liberal reputation, he was anxious not to be seen to be giving in to dictators. Like Chamberlain, Eden also found Vansittart's incessant harping on the German threat unhelpful, and he had already lined up a possible replacement, Sir Alexander Cadogan, an aristocratic career diplomat who Eden had got to know on Britain's delegation to the League of Nations. As soon as Baldwin had appointed him, Eden had invited Cadogan to return from his posting as ambassador to China so that he could serve as Vansittart's deputy and future successor. Where Vansittart was volatile, spiky, and increasingly given to writing interminable memoranda on the need to stand up to Hitler, Cadogan was calm, smooth and pragmatic in his desire to match Britain's foreign policies with what it could actually do. For the moment, he was also more optimistic about the prospect of arranging a settlement with Germany. So this gives us some very valuable context. As always happens, particularly in Great Britain, behind the doors of Number 10, there are conflicting priorities from ministers and senior civil servants about the policy to take. Chamberlain believed that an agreement with Germany was ultimately possible, and began to build around him people like Wilson and Eden and Cadogan, who would then drown out the Vansittarts, the Doom Choirs. And also, the way that Chamberlain saw things, and the way that Chamberlain's cabinet began to see things, was that one could only have the foreign policy that one's military force can support. And so a kind of an element of pragmatism and realpolitik underpinned what Chamberlain was trying to do. Chamberlain's ultimately kind of naive, we only know this kind of after the event, was naive in his belief that a general settlement could be reached. But this was the kind of the holy grail that politicians and diplomats, British politicians and diplomats, had been searching for since 1919, when it was fairly clear at the end of the Paris Peace Conference that an imperfect peace, an incomplete peace, and a transient one had been created. There were, at the Genoa Conference, at the Locarno Treaties, successive attempts to create a kind of a more lasting settlement, you know, for example, the Washington Naval Conferences. And by the mid-1920s, there's almost a moment where it's thought that it's been achieved, it's been done. But this was not to be. So here was, by the late 1930s, when the kind of time is running short, and everyone's painfully aware of that, a last-ditch attempt to create a lasting world settlement. One of the key sort of delineators of the 20th century is obviously the Second World War, and it's important when you look at kind of the levels of soft and hard power that Britain had before the Second World War, that British prime ministers, successive British prime ministers, took on the roles that US presidents would have after the Second World War in terms of global diplomacy, of trying to create settlements that would ensure lasting eras of peace, however successfully or unsuccessfully. The fact that no British Prime Minister has, after the Second World War, ever seriously seen that ever again as Britain's role is quite telling. Margaret Macmillan, in her book Peacemakers, wrote that the fact that there was indeed 20 years of relative peace between the great powers, of course not 20 years of peace at all, because there are countless wars during that time, 20 years of relative peace between the great powers, was actually a testament that things had gone as well as they possibly could do at the Paris Peace Conference. So, one key aspect of Chamberlain and Eden's relationship was Eden's belief that the dictators of Europe couldn't be trusted and couldn't be dealt with and couldn't be negotiated with. The thing that really set Chamberlain and Eden apart, writes Daniel Todman, was the Foreign Secretary's hatred of Mussolini. The Italian dictator's broken promises about non-intervention in Spain had left Eden deeply suspicious of any rapprochement. Compared to Chamberlain, Eden was much less worried about the risk of the empire being attacked simultaneously by Germany, Italy and Japan. That meant he had much more room to insist on a firm stance was taken with the Duce. Chamberlain, however, saw an improvement of relations with Italy as a stepping stone to a general European settlement. During the summer of 1937, He preferred recognition of Italy's conquest of Abyssinia in the hope of reducing tensions in the Mediterranean and severing the developing connection between Rome and Berlin. When Italy joined Germany and Japan in the anti-Comintern Pact that November, he saw it as further evidence of the need to bring Mussolini back on side. For Eden, on the other hand, it was proof of the uselessness of relying on Italian promises. So this is a really interesting dynamic here. The worse behaviour in terms of diplomacy and war that Mussolini displays, the more kind of aggressive, acquisitive behaviour that Mussolini displays, the more Chamberlain convinces himself that this is evidence that we really should redouble our efforts to try to bring Mussolini back on side by acknowledging that his acquisition of Abyssinia is fine. And in a way, the policy of appeasement begins with Italy. The policy of appeasement begins not with Chamberlain visiting Hitler to offer him the Sudetenland. It begins with Chamberlain offering Mussolini the Abyssinia, the recognition of the Abyssinia that he had conquered. In July 1937, a military scuffle between the Chinese and Japanese forces in northern China escalated rapidly into a full-blown but undisclosed war. As Japanese armies advanced rapidly in the north and fierce fighting raged all around the international settlement in Shanghai, China's nationalist government sought international support. Eager to tie the Japanese down in China, the Soviet Union sent arms and military advisers but would not sign an alliance that would drag the Red Army into the conflict. In the West, the nationalists aimed their diplomatic efforts at the United Kingdom, supposedly the other major power in East Asia. Aware as they were of the weakness of the defences in the Far East, the British did not do much to help. No British minister wanted to be dragged into a repeat of the Abyssinian debacle, with the League of Nations imposing sanctions on the Royal Navy and the Royal Navy forced into a naval confrontation with the Japanese as a result. London therefore carefully diffused China's appeal to the League, removing any mention of a war which would then have compelled action from the signatories of the Washington Treaty, and condemning Japan's actions without binding the UK to do anything about them. So here again we have an example of Chamberlain's appeasement. And I think before we are too quick to condemn, too quick to judge, too quick to criticise, the fact is that Chamberlain existed in a situation that, I mean, he was kind of largely optimistic about solving, but to a great many people around him, it was an almost kind of impossible puzzle to solve. Ultimately, you know, within a decade, the British Empire is largely swept away by the war that then comes. The British are appalled by the assault of Japan against China. But it's still easy enough for the British government to ignore because of the geography of the situation, the distance away that China was, and the ability to say, well, you know, we know nothing of these people, to paraphrase a later statement by Chamberlain. Anyway, we're going to look more at this period of time and Chamberlain's decision-making in the next few weeks as we focus on the diplomatic processes that lead to the declaration of war by Germany on Germany by Britain on September the 3rd, 1939. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this. Do swing by the Explaining History website, explaininghistory.org. It's really developing quite nicely now. We've got a huge... The entire playlist is on the front landing page as you go there. There are some new articles, and you can support us on Patreon. where you can get some exclusive content that I'm putting on there at the moment. There's a great new blog. I've recently done an essay about the Red Army faction, the Bader-Meinhof gang, in the late 1960s and early 1970s in Germany. So check it out. And there'll be some more news about the possibility of setting up the Explaining History, for want of a better word, university, coming sometime next year. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.